You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow, and for the rest of the hour, it is a Human Origins update. We're going to be focusing on two developments. New information about the earliest hominids, the ones that lived millions of years ago, not too long after humans and chimps split. And second, more fuel for the debate about whether there was any interbreeding between Neanderthals and early humans. Scientists believe that humans and chimps split from a common ancestor about 6 to 8 million years ago, but they don't know exactly how this split happened. There is very little fossil evidence from this period. Now, in a paper published in the journal Science, researchers present the most complete description yet of those ancient hominids, and what they found is causing them to redraw our family tree. Now, you fast forward a few million years to the much more recent past, the fossilized bones of Neanderthals, which were first discovered in the 19th century, and ever since scientists have been arguing over whether they belong to our human ancestry tree. And one big question is whether early humans and Neanderthals interbred, or if they kept their genes to themselves. In the current issue of the journal Public Library of Science Biology, scientists turn to molecular evidence for an answer, and they conclude that Neanderthals and humans probably did not exchange DNA. No hanky-panky between Neanderthals and the early humans. We're going to talk about what they found. And if you'd like to join our discussion, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And you can always surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Let me introduce my guests. Svante Paabo is the director of the Department of Genetics at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig. He joined us today by phone from San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Tim White is a professor of integrative biology at the University of California at Berkeley. He joins us today from the campus there. Welcome back to the program, Dr. White.
Hi, Ira.
Hi there. Dr. Paabo, you're trying to figure out whether Neanderthals and early humans interbred.
Yes.
And give us a little history of that controversy.
So there are sort of historically two major ideas about the origin of modern humans, so humans that are indistinguishable from us in their skeletons. And one idea says that our ancestry to a big extent goes back to early human forms that evolve in Africa and then leave Africa around 2 million years ago, and eventually evolve into different regional forms. And one such forms are the Neanderthals, which existed in Europe and Western Asia and until they disappear a little after 30,000 years ago. And modern humans appear first in the Middle East and later on in Europe, starting around 100,000 years ago or so. And the big question is, what happened? What was the interaction between these early modern humans and the Neanderthals? Is it so that modern Europeans even evolved from Neanderthals, or at least absorbed a lot of genes from them? Or, as other people believe, did early modern humans evolve in Africa, spread out of the world, and replace these earlier forms, archaic forms of humans, mm-hmm. without mixing with them?
Mm-hmm. And so you did a DNA analysis?
Yes.
And of what?
So what we have sort of developed technology for doing over the past few years is to retrieve short pieces of DNA that remain in some fossils. And the pieces one can retrieve are pieces of the mitochondrial genome. So this is a part of our genome that occur in many copies, maybe 500 to 1,000 copies per cell, whereas most of the rest of our genome occur in only two copies, one from the father and one from the mother. So it's easier to retrieve this mitochondrial DNA, and you can then compare it to big, big surveys of this piece of the genome in present-day living humans.
Mm-hmm. And you found there was really no cross, so to speak, breeding of between the Neanderthals and the early humans?
Well, what we find is that the DNA we find in the Neanderthals look quite different from what we see in modern humans.
Mm-hmm.
And we have then, what is new in this piece of work is that we've gone back and looked in five early modern humans that were partially contemporaneous with the Neanderthals. So they could have met the Neanderthals, or their recent ancestor could have. And we then look for this Neanderthal typical DNA in them. which would be evidence for interbreeding. And we can't find that. Now, of course, one has to have caveats with this. One has to admit that this is just five early modern humans we looked at and so on. But there is no positive evidence of interbreeding.
Mm-hmm. So, you don't assume the other version just because you can't find evidence of
it. Now I didn't get quite what you meant, Ira.
I mean, you're saying you found five instances, but none of the, you know, so you didn't find, well, forget what I said. I'm agreeing with you, basically. Tim White, you study fossils from this period. Dr. Pabo's findings jive with the fossil evidence there?
Yes, what we're seeing, Ira, is we're coming to the same answers from two completely independent sources, genetics and the fossil record. We've been working in an area, as you know, in the Horn of Africa, mm-hmm. in the Afar Depression, and we published last summer in Nature actually the earliest Homo sapiens, something we call Homo sapiens edaltu, which shows that on the African continent, long before the Neanderthals went extinct in Europe, you have anatomically modern humans, and these would have been the ancestors of those fossils that Savante and his colleagues have sampled in Europe and compared with the Neanderthal mitochondrial DNA. So it's very nice to see this complementation and integration of the two different data sets.
Any idea why so far, you mentioned before, Dr. Pabo and Dr. White, why Neanderthals did die out, and you know why our lineage does not extend to them?
So yes, there is a lot of speculation mm-hmm. about that, and sometimes I sort of tend to say that the kinds of speculations we do say more about our own prejudice and ideas about humans than what actually happened. But there are one very common idea, for example, that early modern humans would have had articulate language that was sort of similar to present-day language and more efficient than the language of the Neanderthals. But that sort of remains a pure speculation, of course.
Tim, any jump in on that one?
Gene Ahl has sold an awful lot of books with the stories about that. I agree with Savante.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking about the origins of man and about whether there was, you know, where, how far back. Tim, take us through human evolution about where we think possibly the split came between humans and chimpanzees.
Well, this is something, again, where we see an integration and complementation of molecular and fossil data. It wasn't always so. If you go back to the 1970s, it was thought that humans and chimps split way back at 15 million years ago. Mm-hmm. And some of the work done here in the biochemistry department by an anthropologist named Vince Sarich and Alan Wilson in Biochem did quite a bit of the early molecular work to demonstrate that the split between humans and the African apes was, in evolutionary terms, quite recent. Recent meaning, in this case, some 6 to 8 million years ago. Now, the problem for us is that we've had a pretty good set of fossils, both from the European theater, but also from Asia, and increasingly from Africa. And in Africa, we can see, from anatomically modern humans, we can see a succession of more and more primitive hominids going mm-hmm. back into the past. So that by the time we get to the bottom of Olduvai Gorge, at 2 million years ago, we see one extinct form, now extinct, a large chewing primate known as Paranthropus or Australopithecus robustus. This is a line that specialized and went extinct, much as the Neanderthal would do later in Europe. But as we trace the roots of the other species at the base of Olduvai Gorge, Homo habilis, back into the past, we come back to 3 million years ago, and we get to these creatures known as Australopithecus afarensis, or more popularly known, and known on the basis of a fairly complete skeleton from Ethiopia, known as Lucy, mm-hmm. who lived about 3 to 3.2 million years ago, and many people recognize as a human ancestor because she has a lot of human characteristics. Now, until a few years ago, we didn't really know anything from the fossil record about that gap between her and the time that the molecules were suggesting a divergence. It was kind of a black hole in the fossil record. we've been able to fill some of that black hole in and approach that divergence more closely than has ever before been possible due to the discoveries that have been made since about 1997.
In fact, you published a recent paper which takes us much earlier than the time, back to that nearly 6 million years ago period, not long after humans and chimps split. Tell us about that paper, and it actually adds a new line, does it not? Another branch of our ancestry?
Yes, it does. It's actually, the work began in 1997 by Johannes Haile Selassie, who is now at the Cleveland Museum of Natural History.
Is he related and to actually, the? Is he related to the Haile Selassie?
No relationship.
Okay, just wanted to make sure.
He started as a Berkeley graduate student here at Cal and became one of the projects. In fact, the project's top fossil finder and interpreter right now. Mm-hmm. In '97, he went out to an area of the Middle Awash, this area in the Afar that we're working in, and he found a jaw of a creature whose anatomy was a little bit different from what we'd seen before, and over the years he's found more and more of this. The most recent paper describes some of the upper teeth from this primate that we've named Ardipithecus cadaba, and this Ardipithecus gives us a glimpse of what these hominids were like at about 5.8 million years ago. And the thing that's important to remember here, of course, is that the molecules can tell you a lot about relationships and whether or not things like Neanderthals interbred with early anatomically modern people in Europe. The molecules can triangulate in, and in a sense you can study modern apes, as Jane Goodall does with chimpanzees, and you can learn a lot about the modern world. But these 6 million-year-old worlds are, in a sense, lost worlds, and the only way that we can recover them is as paleontologists going out into these regions like the Afar of Ethiopia, finding new fossils and trying to throw some new light on the anatomy and the behavior and the environment that these creatures occupied so long ago.
Mm-hmm. And you have found in this with these teeth here that there was another separate branch that died out that you just separated?
No, what we've done is to find, in a sense, Lucy's ancestor.
Uh-huh.
Because what we're able to do is to compare these teeth that have been found, particularly the canine tooth, not only the fossils we've found in Ethiopia, but the broader picture here that's emerging from Africa, from the work in Chad, in Central Africa, and work in Kenya. We have a whole set of these fossils, and you can't think of it as a big set. It's not a pickup truck full yet. It's more like a briefcase full of fossils. There are some thigh bones from Kenya. There are teeth and jaws from all three sites. There's a cranium from Chad. And all of these primates show a very interesting phenomenon that is shared with Lucy, and that is that even the male individuals lack big projecting canine teeth. And so in that sense, they're not chimpanzee-like. They're a little more primitive than later hominids like Lucy, but already at this time, these are primates who have changed in anatomy from ape precursors. And we have lots and lots of apes mm-hmm. all over the old world at 10 million years ago, so we know what those are like. But we're starting to fill this gap. And what we're seeing is some form of bipedality at around 6 million years ago. The brain case hasn't expanded at all. The canine teeth are quite small. In fact, this is a unique primate. And that's why, of course, it has a new name, Ardipithecus cadaba.
Mm-hmm. Talking about primates this hour, Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. So you penciled in how much of the gap did you pencil in, do you think? How many spanning between what and what?
Think of it this way. In about 1992, mm-hmm. if you'd ask me that question, I would say we have a very good record back to about 3.5 million years ago.
Right.
Now we have a record that's pretty good back to 4.5 million years ago, and we're starting to fill in this gap between 5 and 7 million years ago. So we're starting to be able to explore this time period for the first time.
Svante, can you tell Dr. White or any of these people who are looking what the years by looking at your DNA, what the critical time periods are?
So, what we can do, and what already Alan Wilson, as Tim said, did, was to sort of estimate the time when the lineage to chimps and lineage to humans diverged, say 4 to 8 million years ago or so. Mm-hmm. What is also coming these days, and is extremely interesting, is the fact that the chimpanzee genome is being sequenced, or has been sequenced, actually. The DNA sequence is available on the web since the end of last year. So what we can now start doing is to sort of look at individual genes that might be involved in some of these important changes that took place in the time that Dr. White is discussing here. So, for example, there is a gene that is involved in the development of speech and language, where we have shown that it was changed and was the target of selection quite recently, within the last 500,000 years or so, on the human lineage. And there's another gene involved in the growth of the brain that a group in Chicago has shown was a target of selection, so it changed a few million years ago. So I think that actually the molecular work and the fossil work will come together even more in the future, when the geneticists will start homing in on the genes that may be responsible for some of these changes you can observe in the fossils.
That's fascinating, but does that mean you have to go out and find more of those genes in the fossils?
No. This will be work that comes from comparing present-day chimpanzees, present-day humans with each other, and inferring, trying to date the changes one sees there by the number of mutations that have happened in the genome. We are really limited when it comes to retrieving DNA from the actual fossils to things that are not older than, say, this, for sure, this side of 1,000,000 years, probably this side of 500,000 years.
Tim White, sounds exciting.
Yeah, Savante is being quite humble about his accomplishments. He and his team have done some remarkable things to be able to extract this DNA and to assess it, but they've only been able to do that with fossils in these European cave deposits, at least in my understanding. Perhaps Savante can talk a little more about this. The fossilization processes in the open air sites and the very, very old sites in Africa have not allowed any DNA to be extracted. It's effectively gone now and can't be recovered, which is extremely unfortunate for us. It means that we're left with the form of the bone or the tooth itself, and we have to make our inferences from that since we can't extract the DNA from these very, very ancient remains.
I'm surprised that DNA even that old can be taken out of these fossils.
Yes, it's sort of... Originally, I was actually surprised also 12 years ago when we first found this that we could at all retrieve DNA. And it does seem to be much a function of not only the age, but also the temperature, actually. Mm-hmm. So we have not been able to retrieve DNA from Neanderthals from the Middle East so far, for example. Mm-hmm. Whereas we can do it in Europe, and we can go back even further when we go to the permafrost and look at mammoths in Siberia, for example.
All right, we have to break in, Dr. Pablo. Let me stop you right now. We'll take our break and come back and talk lots more with you and Tim White, also Svante Pablo. So stay with us. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about human origins with my guests, Tim White, professor of integrative biology at the University of California in Berkeley, Dr. Svante Pabo, director of the Department of Genetics at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig, Germany. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Lots of listeners want to get in on the conversation. Let's see if we can do that. Steve in Sacramento. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you doing?
Hi, go ahead.
Good. First, a general comment. I thought it was interesting that Savani said that, our own prejudices might... lead to our conclusions in a lot of cases, and I find that a very telling comment since I'd come to different conclusions about the data sets I've heard about. But just a specific question here. Was a comparison done on the mitochondrial DNA from, say, a human being from today and the five that he studied from, I understand it was only 500,000 years ago? Mm-hmm. I'll take the answer off the air.
Thanks. Okay, thanks.
So, yes, so what we have done is to look at five early modern humans and look if they contain any mitochondrial DNA from the Neanderthals. And then we add up that evidence to all the modern humans, thousands of modern humans that have been looked at, where one also doesn't find this DNA. And then we sort of set up a sort of population genetic model, and under some assumptions that we then have, we can say we can exclude any genetic contribution of Neanderthals that would have been bigger than 25%. Mm-hmm. So that still leaves quite a bit of room for a possible contribution. However, it's also true that there is no positive evidence of contribution, so that it could have been zero. Let us also, I don't know if Steve sort of hinted at this, it's also true, of course, that what we study here is the mitochondrial DNA. And that is inherited maternally, which means I have my mitochondrial DNA from my mother and not from my father. She has it from her my grandmother, from my great-grandmother, and so on. So we study the female side of history here. So if there was a contribution from Neanderthals that involved only Neanderthal men and excluding females, we would not detect it either. So there are clear-cut sort of limitations to what we can see, just like with any scientific method.
And you're saying that because you're basing on just five occurrences here?
I'm saying the last thing because we're basing it on mitochondrial DNA, mm-hmm. where we only see the female side mm-hmm. of things.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Tim, what kind of fossils, you mentioned that you're closing in on the gaps there. What kind of fossil records or fossils would you like to find to close, and where would you look for them?
Well, right now, Ira, we have initiated something called the Researching Hominid Origins Initiative here in Berkeley. It's funded by the National Science Foundation. It involves 14 different countries, and these countries stretch from Spain all the way over into China and from Greece all the way down to South Africa. That's the sort of old world dimension, and we're looking at the period focusing on 5 to 7 million years ago in Africa, but looking adjacently to understand this planet of the apes that came before hominids and the sort of planet of the monkeys that came after these earlier hominids. We are right now in a sort of a planet of the monkeys, believe it or not, because the great apes are very few and very endangered.
But was it really that widespread about?
It's full of monkeys.
Let me just get the picture of what it looked like back then. Was it really just really a planet of the apes spread
all
over?
If you take it back to 10 million years ago, you find some very fascinating creatures. There's one that lived in Turkey that had great big back teeth, a kind of a chewing machine ape.
Right.
There were a very specialized one called Oreopithecus that lived in Italy. There are ones from all over Kenya. Oh, yeah, right, exactly. The cookie ape, it's often called. And so you have this wide diversity of apes and very few monkey species. And if you go out into a West African forest today, you find the opposite of that. You have a few gorillas and chimpanzees and some humans penetrating into those areas, but most of the primate species out there are monkeys. So there's been a real turnover across the time period between 10 and 5 million years ago. So what we're doing on this initiative is to focus a lot of different teams in, working at a lot of different sites, to try to generate new evidence. Our colleague Michel Brunet, who announced this new cranium in Chad, is supported by this initiative. He, in fact, just came back from the desert last week.
Right.
So we're hoping all the time that these field teams out there are going to provide more fossils, because that's really what we need. It's very tough to find these deposits. We have a few where we work in the Horn of Africa in Ethiopia, but it's really tough to find these very ancient rocks, and even tougher to find the rocks that have the primate fossils in them.
Do you suspect there might have been some catalytic event that suddenly forced the change from the planet of the apes to the planet of the monkeys?
Well, I'm not as much an environmental determinist as many of my colleagues are. Mm-hmm. I think that behavior is a far more important force to be reckoned with here, mm-hmm. and I think that we're seeing, by looking at these printouts of the genes, and we have to think of the fossils in that sort of gross way, that's what the genes have created so many million years ago. We still have the form of that creation in the form of the teeth and the jaws and the pieces of the skeleton that we study. And by studying that, we can learn quite a bit about these organisms. And these hominids that are being found from these 5 to 7 million-year-old sites in Africa, because we have the anatomy, we can understand something of their behavior, and none of them have the big male canines that are used in male-male competition among the modern great apes or modern monkeys. And so this is telling us, I think, something very important about their behavior, and it's going along with what we're learning from the bones below the neck. The thigh bones from Kenya that were found by the team in Paris show that this is a creature with some form of bipedality. We'd like to find a lot more of these creatures, because the more we find, the more we'll learn about their behavior and their locomotion. and their all of the things that they were doing and the world that they were living in back then so many years ago.
So you'd like to find the body parts, the parts of their body where they're actually moving around, so you can see when that occurred, that changed.
Absolutely. Yeah. For example, the sort of keystones who are being able to walk on two legs as we do, and which differentiates us from all these other primates, is the pelvis. Mm-hmm. But the pelvis is a really tough bone to find. It's quite soft, and when a hyena ravages a carcass after an organism dies, it's one of the first bones that gets chewed away. So we end up with lots of jaws and teeth, and we're always hoping to find that skeleton out there. The skeletons are the sort of Rosetta Stones in our study of human evolution, because they combine the head parts, the teeth, with the rest of the locomotor skeleton. It allows us to look at biology very effectively. That's why they become famous, like the little partial skeleton from Ethiopia, Lucy.
Is that the rich area now? Is that the richest area to find the parts you're looking for?
Ethiopia is one, I think, of the central ones, probably the central one. It's a really fascinating and diverse country that's taken the lead in this science, not just with the fossils that are coming out of the field, but you also see that the lead author on this last paper is Yohannes Haile Selassie. Here's a young PhD from Ethiopia doing work in Ethiopia on the world stage. So that's fantastic to see. We want to boost that up. We're doing the same thing in